I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, mega earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, and floods have literally shaped human history, and they are bound to shape our future as well. We'll spend this hour with seismologist Lucy Jones, former science advisor for risk reduction at the U.S. Geological Survey. Jones spent years modeling the destruction that will happen when the big one convulses the San Andreas or New Madrid faults, and she says human decisions will determine whether these inevitable natural events turn into catastrophes. We'll talk about why earthquakes remain so unpredictable and about why it's dangerous to assume our past experience with disasters means we can handle whatever might happen next. Our conversation starts after a short break. If you're old enough to remember the Northridge earthquake in 1994, you'll recall that it kept Southern California in national headlines for weeks. It was a magnitude 6.7, strong enough to be felt in Las Vegas, and the shaking lasted between 10 and 20 seconds. 8,700 people were hurt, 57 died, portions of major freeways were rendered unusable for months until they could be rebuilt. But that wasn't the big one that people living near the southern San Andreas Fault have been warned to brace for. Seismologists say that quake could last much longer and be many, many times stronger than the Northridge quake. And it's not a matter of whether that will happen, but when. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Dr. Lucy Jones is a research associate at Caltech. She spent 30 years as a seismologist with the U.S. Geological Survey, most recently as science advisor for risk reduction. She worries that we're complacent about all kinds of world-changing catastrophes, from earthquakes to volcanoes to floods, and that our experience with relatively minor emergencies has lulled us into a false sense of security. So she wants us all to understand how these events have affected human existence in the past and how they could be worse in the future. Her book, out now in paperback, is called The Big Ones: How Natural Disasters Have Shaped Us and What We Can Do About Them. She joins us from the studios of KPCC in Pasadena, California. Lucy, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
You say natural disasters are spatially predictable, which is to say we know where earthquakes and floods and volcanic eruptions take place. We still can't say when they'll happen with any certainty. And if it's been a while since something bad has happened, we have this tendency to tell ourselves it won't happen. What's going on there?
Well, human beings have something that the social scientists call a normalization bias. We think that what we have to deal with is what we have dealt with. The imminent threat is much more important than the long-term one. And you can see evolutionarily, if you worried about the 100-year flood and ignored the wolf about to eat your children, that wasn't a good thing. So we are definitely evolved to believe in the currency of our risk. And of course, the problem is the way natural disasters work, there are always many more smaller ones, but when you have a place that has many small ones, at some point, much more rarely, they have a big one. And this just leaves us unprepared to deal with that. It's a place where science can help you manage it if you believe it.
Well, earthquakes happen many times a day in many parts of the world. Most of them are too small to be felt by people. But whether they stay small or grow cataclysmic, they all basically start the same way?
That's what it's looking like. I mean, we thought there would probably be something that we could tell them apart, but the more we look and the more we analyze them, I mean, the difference in a small and a large earthquake is how far you rip down the fault. Imagine you rip a piece of paper. If you just put a little tear in it, it lasts a short amount of time. You have a little bit of noise coming off. If you rip across the whole page, it lasts longer and you produce more sound. Well, the same thing with the earthquake is it starts on the fault, and as it, you essentially have a, like just like the tear moves down the paper, you have a rupture front moving down the fault. And where it stops is what controls how big it is. But right now, when we look at the very beginning of all the earthquakes, they all look the same.
Hmm. So this book is a lot about science, but it's also a lot about human nature. Why are we so susceptible to conspiracy theory following a disaster?
Because we're trying to make a pattern. It's, in fact, the lack of pattern that really scares us. Huh. Thinking back on, how we're evolved, our brains were what kept us safe against the predators, right? They had bigger teeth or stronger muscles, but we had a better brain and we could make patterns and figure out how to make ourselves safe. And when faced with a danger, we try really hard to make a pattern. And if the timing is fundamentally random, you know, why did this generation get hit by the volcanic eruption and another one didn't, and it really is just random, we have a really horrible time accepting that, and we try to make a pattern. And so after the earthquake, where's the pattern? How do we be safe? And there are aftershocks happening. And it's astonishing. Essentially, every significant earthquake we've had in California, within 3 days, there is a rumor going around that the scientists know that there's another earthquake coming, and we're not saying it to avoid a panic, which puts us in a difficult position because if we deny it, we're sort of that the rumor said we were going to deny it, so we're confirming it.
Right.
And it's it happens every time, and it's just it's human nature trying to find a way to be safe.
You can say with some certainty that there are likely to be aftershocks, right?
That's right. That's the one thing about earthquakes that we really can predict. When one earthquake happens, it makes others more likely. And mostly they're smaller and we call them aftershocks. But about 5% of the time, the aftershock grows bigger than the main shock. And then we change the name and call the first one a foreshock. But the foreshock doesn't look any different than all of those other earthquakes that we have.
One thing that you explained here that I didn't understand before is that the reason that only big earthquakes happen along the San Andreas Fault is that all the little ones have happened already.
Well, basically, yes. So it's big if it keeps on moving down the fault. And the San Andreas has had so much motion that it's been ground really, really smooth. And now when a rupture starts, there's nothing to stop it. So for the 150 years that we've been recording earthquakes, you know, people have been here in Southern California and we've had network seismometers for 80 years, we have not seen an earthquake on the Southern San Andreas Fault. Plenty of them around it, near it, secondary faults, but not the main fault itself.
I mean, does it ever feel like musical chairs, like you keep, you know, sort of expecting it to happen at any moment and it doesn't and the anticipation builds? I mean, for you as a scientist, on the one hand, this would be really an extraordinary event to be able to study, and yet it's going to come with a lot of devastation.
Right. I mean, as a resident, I don't want to have to go through it. As a scientist, I've spent my life studying this thing. I sort of hate to miss it. And, you know, when I came here to Caltech in 1983, the people were estimating the probability that the earthquake would happen within, you know, we pick an arbitrary time of 30 years, it was like 50%. It's a couple percent a year chance of having that earthquake. And I really thought I'd see it before the end of my career. And now I'm wondering if I'll see it before the end of my life. There's part of me that really does want to see it because we've studied it. We've said what it should be. We have all these instruments waiting to record it. And I'd sort of hate to miss it. But for the sake of LA, I suppose every year we put it off is a year we can get better prepared. So that's also a good thing.
Is that happening?
It is actually happening. It's pretty exciting. Historically, the only seismic safety legislation has happened in the immediate aftermath of a big earthquake. You know, there was an earthquake in 1933 that destroyed a lot of schools. Luckily, when the schools were not in session, brought in a law to make stronger schools. And that's just happened every time. But we'd never seen it move without a big earthquake. And we are now. It's partly science communication that's happening more effectively. We made this really concrete, defined model of what we thought the big earthquake would be like. So it would be, we called it a scenario. It's called the shakeout scenario. And that gives people a concrete sense of what the event is really going to be and what the implications of their decisions are. I ended up getting the opportunity. The Mayor Garcetti of Los Angeles invited me to come and work with them in City Hall to develop better seismic safety legislation. And I spent 2014 as a U.S. Geological Survey employee, but in partnership with the city and working with his staff to look at what would be the cost-effective measures. And we managed to get through the biggest seismic safety legislation the state's ever seen. 14,000 of a particularly bad type of building, mostly apartments. If you remember from the Northridge earthquake, there were these horrible images of what was called the Northridge Meadows apartment building, where the first floor was a garage and it collapsed, and 17 people died in the building. And that type of building is now under mandatory retrofit in the city of Los Angeles. 14,000 buildings, half of them have already gotten into the retrofit process. So they're actually ahead of schedule. And then there's a bunch of other things of improving water systems and telecommunication systems that are moving forward. So I actually think it's an impact of globalization. I remember we began this discussion about the normalization bias. We think that what we've had is what we've got to deal with. But now we are seeing the disasters elsewhere in the world. And while the really big earthquakes are very infrequent in any one location, a magnitude 8 happens somewhere in the year, about once a year. And we start seeing other cities dealing with the issue, watching the impact in Tokyo or in Indonesia. And it makes it more real for us. And I think that's helping people overcome their normalization bias, because we have a visceral experience in a way we couldn't before the modern era of telecommunications.
It's hard to imagine the magnitude of a flood, and forgive my use of the word magnitude, a wrong choice here, the size of the flood that washed away Sacramento, California, and hundreds of other towns in the 19th century. There was a giant flood on the Mississippi. And yet, I think a lot of people living in those places today haven't even heard that these things happened.
Well, here in California, the worst disaster in our history was this flood in 1861-62. It killed about 1% of the population and destroyed 1/3 of the taxable land and bankrupted the state. And yet most Californians don't know that it happened. Of course, most Californians have family that came here sometime after that, and that's one of the issues. The Mississippi, you should think, you know, that's, you've got the blues to help you remember. I mean, that's the ongoing history of the region. One thing that happens, of course, is we build our big engineering projects to try and protect us, and they do successfully protect us from the smaller events, which takes away the reminder that the really, really big events could happen. Mm. That said, the Mississippi flood in 1927 was one of the most devastating disasters in American history. They built, redid the control of the Mississippi after that, and the winter, I think it was spring of 2011, the rainfall and all the conditions were as bad or worse than 1927. And because of the control systems, it didn't flood. So, you know, engineering does get us a long way. Our problem is remembering that however big a flood control system you build, there's always the possibility of a flood that will overcome it.
Yeah, that Mississippi flood left how many people homeless or at least out of their homes for a significant amount of time?
There were, I think it was over 600. I'm trying to remember if it was over 600,000 people in refugee camps or total displaced, and half of that in refugee camps. It was hundreds of thousands of people. One thing is that they were overwhelming. The majority were African American. It's impoverished, and a lot of those conditions became worse. And I think that's one of the other things, sort of psychologically, we look at disasters and say they hit everybody. Who knows where the flood's going to come? Who knows when the earthquake's going to hit? Which buildings are going to come down? And the reality is that the poor always suffer more. They are in the substandard housing. They're in the lower lying areas. And then they have less resources with which to recover. So the impact of disasters are not equal opportunity.
And that happened in the past, and it continues up through today if we look at a disaster like Katrina.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in my book, I have one chapter on the 1927 flood and one on Katrina. And when I first started to write it, I was like, but this is the same. This
same
is the
story.
Same. All of these things that had happened, there were these really, it was like this complete parallel. And actually my editor, when I, my first round on it, said, you can't do this. It's just like a repeat. And I actually was able to find, it was actually an important part Readjusting, Becoming a Better Book. I love a good editor.
My guest is Lucy Jones, a research associate at Caltech who spent 30 years as a seismologist with the U.S. Geological Survey, most recently as science advisor for risk reduction. Her book is called The Big Ones, How Natural Disasters Have Shaped Us and What We Can Do About Them. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find us on Twitter. We are at @KERAThink. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with seismologist Lucy Jones, a research associate at Caltech who was science advisor for risk reduction to the U.S. Geological Survey. Her book, which is out now in paperback, is called The Big Ones, How Natural Disasters Have Shaped Us and What We Can Do About Them. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. All right, let's go back to maybe the first natural disaster that many people learn about when they're small children, and that is the eruption of Mount Vesuvius, the destruction of Pompeii. It wasn't the lava that killed people, but the gas?
A combination. It was something called a pyroclastic flow, which is a combination of superheated gases coming out with volcanic ash. As the magma, if the magma runs over the, comes out of the ground and runs over the ground, it's called lava. When it, if it gets blown up into the air because of explosive gases, it freezes into little tiny particles that are called volcanic ash. And so a pyroclastic flow is a combination of the ash and the hot gases. It's the fact that it's explosive and goes up into the air instead of down over the ground. And that's the type of volcanoes that you get in wherever we've got what geologists call a subduction zone, where in Italy or Japan or Indonesia, South America, Mexico, all of those are going to be more explosive, whereas like Hawaii or Iceland, you're more likely to see the lava flowing over the ground. The funny thing that I was quite surprised when I discovered this in really researching what happened in Pompeii is that 90% of the people lived. The eruption began with an explosion that went up into the air. The air, everything turns black. Most people panicked and ran away. But there was a smaller percentage of people that said, it's raining rocks on you outside. I think I'm better off staying in my house. And they were there then when the pyroclastic flow came through about 12 hours after the start of the eruption.
And then there was Pliny the Elder, who just wanted to observe this phenomenon.
Isn't he great? Yeah. Pliny the Elder wrote the first encyclopedia that we know about in Western culture, and was clearly a very curious man. And he was head of the fleet there at the Roman fleet in the Bay of Naples, and got asked for help. And he wanted to get over and see what was going on and record what was happening. Unfortunately, he was an older man, and it sounds like quite corpulent and not in the best of health, and he collapsed and died while this was going on. They think he probably had a heart attack, perhaps triggered by problems breathing with the gases in the air.
Pliny the Younger had the good sense to get out of town.
Pliny the Younger said, yeah, go ahead, uncle, go take off. And then when the eruption got worse, he helped his elderly mother out. He had a great passage in there where he said, I was sure that the world was ending, but I took a small consolation. I was sure that I would die, but I took a small consolation that the rest of the world was ending with me. They really thought it was the end of the world.
That earthquake that flattened Lisbon in 1755 was really interesting. It might not have taken so many lives if not for the timing of it on a religious holiday.
Well, yes, it both was more deadly because of that and had huge sort of philosophical implications. Yeah. It happened on the morning of All Saints' Day. Of course, Portugal at the time was a completely, very devoutly Catholic country and in the middle of the Inquisition. Everybody would go to church on All Saints' Day, multiple services, so not everybody was in church, but it was in the middle of the most packed service, the 9:30 service, and all of the churches collapsed. All of the churches had burning candles and helped set off the fires. Mm. Essentially, the whole city was destroyed, much of it by the earthquake, and the rest was burned down. So it was an incredibly devastating event to them and provided a major philosophical conundrum, because at the time, Western culture absolutely believed that earthquakes happened because God was mad at you. You know, Psalm 18, the mountains trembled because the Lord is angry. And it was a way of forming a pattern when we didn't know when they were going to happen. It used to, you know, go farther back. The Roman culture would say the gods, you know, you just got in the way of a spat between the gods, and, you know, too bad. The Jewish Christian tradition said, no, God's good. God is not going to just randomly knock you out. So if he hits you with a natural disaster, it must be your fault. It was our way of forming a pattern to make sense of this. And it was such a part of Western culture that even with the Great Enlightenment and the beginning of scientific research, none of it was being applied to earthquakes, because those were God's work. And this provided a very serious problem. Here you had all of the faithful in the church collapsing and dying, and the whorehouses up on the hill and wooden buildings were basically spared. So it made it difficult to continue looking down that path. Some people took it as, well, we thought we were good Catholics, but we clearly haven't killed enough Protestants. Let's go burn a few more at the stake. On the Protestant side, you'd get, we knew that the Inquisition was the work of the devil. What more proof do we need? But for the philosophers, it's a very interesting turning point in Western culture, as people started to grapple with, you know, what do disasters mean and how do they fit into the human endeavor.
This was also one of the first attempts by a central government to do damage mitigation after it was over.
Yeah, it's the prime minister was a man, the Marquess de Pombal, who was extraordinarily effective in responding to the disaster. He saw immediately that it was a crisis issue that needed to be taken, you know, handled very quickly. The king apparently turned to him saying, "What do we do?" And he was quoted as saying, "Sire, we bury the dead and we feed the living," which to me is the most succinct statement of emergency management I think I've ever heard. He proceeded to do that. He also, within a month, they had plans for the rebuilding of Lisbon. He gave people hope. He gave people a reason to stay, and was so effective with it that he gained huge political power and actually managed to stop the Inquisition and get the Jesuits kicked out of Portugal over the next few years. So it's handling a disaster well is a great, great political benefit. But he also, he thought ahead, and the very beginning of earthquake engineering was his endeavor. They made scale models of the buildings they were going to build to rebuild the city, and he had the cavalry run the horses around the scale models to cause the ground to shake and see how the buildings behaved. So, of course, they haven't had such a big earthquake since then, and all of those Pombaline buildings are still there in Lisbon.
Handling a disaster badly or failing to prevent it, even though you sort of presented yourself as almost omnipotent, can ruin a political career, as it did for Mao.
Yes. So, well, Mao, it didn't ruin Mao's political career because he died, right? But there was a longstanding Chinese tradition. So here in the West, we say God's mad at us. In the East, where there's less of a focus on a personal relationship with God, it's more about, you know, social harmony. And the tradition was that earthquakes happened when the yin-yang balance in court became unbalanced. It would be reflected in the natural world and set off earthquakes if there was too much yin, hurricanes if there was too much yang. Since the emperor was the ultimate male symbol, the ultimate yang, earthquakes were seen as a sign that the emperor was going to die. So it's a very long-standing tradition in both Japanese and Chinese culture. And when the Tangshan earthquake hit and killed, you know, 750,000 people, perhaps, it was a time when Mao was already at death's door. He hadn't been seen in public for months. He did not come out because of the event and, in fact, died 6 weeks later. What was interesting is the response then, his... part of that culture, it's Mao's, that the emperor's going to die, but also that the ministers have usurped the emperor's power or women in government. These would be ways to have too much yin in the system. And when they, right after Mao died, the moderates were able to arrest the strong leftists that had been doing the Cultural Revolution, including Mao's widow, was called the Gang of Four. And the indictment of them uses language from these old traditional texts to talk about the use that they had been usurping Mao's power and talking about Madame Mao using her feminine wiles to divert Mao. And it was sort of subconsciously tapping into the cultural norms that said that's what causes earthquakes anyway. And it made the earthquake in a subconscious way, for most people, a reflection of how the Gang of Four had failed.
All right, let's go to the phones. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Ron is on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Ron.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Listen, I have relatives that live in California, west of the San Andreas Fault. And I have relatives that live in western Tennessee and Kentucky near the New Madrid Fault. Whom should I worry about the most?
Thanks for calling.
That's a mixed problem. So the earthquakes happen in California more often than they do in Tennessee, but the state government has done more to prevent the damage in California than has happened in Tennessee or Kentucky. So on a family's time scale, probably the Californians, because they're much more likely to get the earthquake within this time frame. On a multi-generational scale, more in Tennessee, because when the earthquake does happen, they're going to be less able to handle it.
How should we make decisions? I mean, at what point does building to prevent disaster become more expensive than the potential value of saving people?
It does depend on the rate at which happens.
Not people, but property. Forgive me.
Well, all right, so it's both. And that's one of the issues, is that because we're so afraid of the random timing of earthquakes, that we are very afraid of dying in them. And even here in California, the focus has been overwhelmingly on life safety, not on financial protection. So I am far more likely to die on the freeway in California than die in the earthquake in California. That said, I'm far more likely to be bankrupted by the earthquake than anything I do with my car. And we don't necessarily include that. There are studies that show that, in general, in most situations, building a bit stronger is always worthwhile. I mean, if your earthquakes happen, you know, once every 100,000 years, if you're living in North Dakota, really putting in earthquake safety is probably not that cost effective. But about half of the country has enough of an earthquake risk that building a stronger building is a good measure on the long run. Here in California, we're trying to push to go beyond life safety to what we're calling a functional recovery standard. Make buildings that we can use after the earthquake instead of creating disposable buildings. And that adds about 1% to the cost of construction. So we're hoping we can get that measure through, because it seems pretty obvious that 1% now is worth not having the economy collapse later.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. I think something else that people might, maybe not in California, might underestimate, though, is the risk of fires. We all are afraid. We can imagine a building collapsing on top of us. We don't think about what happens in the hours following a major quake.
That's right. And actually, if you want to be terrified about earthquakes, think about it. You're now trapped in a downed building and a fire comes through.
Oh, it, goodness.
Yeah, sorry. But one of the things we have found is that the very biggest earthquakes, right? So we think of a bigger earthquake causing stronger shaking, but the really big factor is it causes strong shaking over a much larger area. Remember I said the difference between a big and a small earthquake is how far down the fault it goes. So when you get to the biggest earthquakes, you get many, many more people. So the Northridge earthquake had about 500,000 people that received really strong shaking. That equivalent level of shaking is going to be experienced by about 10 million people when we have the San Andreas earthquake. So we now have many more places in which fires could be triggered. It happens after every earthquake. It's gotten better as we, you know, move away from cooking on open stoves. But we have gas lines to be broken. We have electrical systems that cause the sparks. So there's a lot of ways in which the fires start. And if you have a Northridge-sized earthquake, we had enough fire engines around to send somebody to every fire. When we have a, 10, 20 times larger area, we don't have that many fire engines. And now the fires are much more likely to be getting out of control. And so the very biggest urban earthquakes, when it's really in the city, the 1906 San Francisco earthquake, the 1755 Lisbon earthquake, 1923 Tokyo earthquake, all of those triggered fires that essentially destroyed the cities. And it's a really major issue in California. We have trouble with fires anyways. The one thing I'd pray for in the earthquake, given that it's inevitable, let's have it when we aren't having Santa Ana winds that might make the fires uncontrollable.
Why did the people of Tokyo, after that quake in 1923, turn on their neighbors, especially Korean immigrant neighbors?
Well, in Japan at the time, Korea was sort of the closest foreign power or foreign country that they had interaction with. Japan had recently conquered Korea and had brought in Koreans as workers, as they were the sort of the technological development, the industrial development in Tokyo. But they already had a pretty strong cultural disdain for the Koreans, much like the racism in the United States with African Americans at the same time. And this horrible earthquake happened, and it was extremely devastating. I was saying that in that culture, the death of the emperor or the prime minister could be seen as a cause of earthquakes. Well, the emperor was so ill at the time, he hadn't been seen in public for 4 years, and the prime minister had died of natural causes a week before the earthquake. So there were really strong cultural reasons to blame the government for causing the earthquake, as irrational as it sounds to put it that way. And there was by diverting the attention towards the Koreans, which was sort of a natural thing of people want to find the other that they can blame. And much in the same way we really blamed the victims in Katrina. It was their fault. Why didn't they leave? Look at that breakdown in social order. When in fact, getting past that immediate time, we find there wasn't a huge breakdown in social order within New Orleans, that a lot of the reports of looting were people trying to get supplies when there was no other option. And so there's, again, it's a sort of this natural human process, but it was a particularly grim one where sort of mob rule took on, and 6,000 Koreans were slaughtered by their neighbors in the 4 days after the earthquake.
My guest is seismologist Lucy Jones, a research associate at Caltech, former science advisor for risk reduction with the U.S. Geological Survey. Her book is called The Big Ones, How Natural Disasters Have Shaped Us and What We Can Do About Them. After this break, we will take more of your questions. You can call us at 800-933-5372 or send us a message on Twitter at KERAThink. Listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Lucy Jones, who spent 30 years as a seismologist with the U.S. Geological Survey, most recently as science advisor for risk reduction, now a research associate at Caltech, and author of the book The Big Ones, How Natural Disasters Have Shaped Us and What We Can Do About Them. If you'd like to join us, you can call 800-933-5372. We have Gary on the line in Waller, Texas. Hi, Gary.
Hello, I actually have a double question. Number one, I heard that there was a prediction, I heard in 2017, that 2018 was going to be a major earthquake year, and I'm wondering how they calculate that. And that led me to ask, does the warming climate have any effect on seismic activity? That is, if the seas are getting warmer and the air is getting warmer, do the rocks get warmer? Does it affect the faults?
Thanks for calling.
Sounds good. Let me start with the latter one, and the answer is no. Because the warming climate is happening in the oceans and air. It's a little over a degree centigrade average increase. And that has a lot of impact on volatile things like air and water. On the Earth, less so. And the earthquakes all begin at least a couple of miles down into the Earth. Right at the surface, the ground doesn't have enough friction. There's not enough confining pressure to cause the friction needed to have the earthquake. So earthquakes usually happen many miles deep into the Earth, and then, you know, the degree or two change on the Earth's surface isn't significant. So climate change, no. The prediction that was made for 2018 being a big year was a hypothesis by one particular group, and it was based on seeing a pattern between on sunspots and seeing there's a variability to earthquakes, and they thought they saw a relationship. It was rather dramatically proved wrong. That's what you get for making predictions on slimmer data. And 2018 was not a particularly active year, even though it was an active sunspot year. So that prediction didn't hold water. And which has happened with just about absolutely every prediction that's been made. So far, we have not found anything that allows us to say when is a more active time.
It seems like a difficult choice for scientists to make. If they feel like they have evidence that might suggest there's more danger ahead, you'd want to share that. On the other hand, there's the boy who cried wolf effect.
Well, mostly, you know, the reality is if anybody was successful in predicting earthquakes, we would be the most famous seismologist ever. Mm. So we have a very strong personal incentive to go out publicly, because nobody's going to believe you if you say, I could have predicted it. There's way too many people that say that. So you really do have to go public beforehand if you want it to be believed. And so, you know, there's often rumors, as I said, you know, rumor that we know there's an earthquake coming and we're not saying anything to avoid a panic. And my response is always just trust to our ambition. If we actually knew something, we'd make sure to tell you.
All right. Let's go back to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We have Linda calling us from Austin. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I'm wondering how many nuclear power plants are near fault lines and what kind of impact is this going to have on our world if we have major earthquakes that are going to destroy nuclear power plants or impact them in some way?
What do you know about that, Lucy?
Okay, obviously that's something people think about when they cite the plants. There have only been two nuclear power plants in California. One of them has been decommissioned. It was having other problems, and it wasn't worth trying to pull it together. The one that's here is called Diablo Canyon. It is near a quite major fault line. When it was built, they put in, criteria for shaking. Nuclear power plants don't do life safety only. They do much stronger construction techniques. I think, and around the world, Japan, of course, has been the site that has the most nuclear power plants with the most earthquakes, and the horrible disaster that happened in 2011. It's interesting when you go in and look in detail there, it got through the earthquake just fine. They had no trouble building a plant in a way that was fine in the earthquake. What happened is the backup power systems, because the power went out for the country because of the disruption from the earthquake, they had backup power for it. The backup power was okay, but the fuel for the backup power was stored at too low an elevation and got knocked out by the tsunami. And so without cooling, then it overheated and they went into the disaster. I don't want to say everything's perfectly wonderful and safe. I would say that it's a place that exacerbates our fears. We are so much more afraid of things we don't see. So the nuclear power plants carry a fear burden that's greater than other types of plants that, in fact, kill a lot of people. You don't see people talking a lot about how many people die because of the air pollution coming out of fossil fuel plants, even though that, in fact, is more people have probably died from pollution from the fossil fuels than have died from anything in a power plant, a nuclear power plant.
To go back to floods for a moment again, one challenge that you write about with flood mitigation is that planners have to balance the need for diverting excessive rainwater and runoff when it happens with the need in many places to capture and store water for times of drought.
Right. I mean, in a place like along the Mississippi, it's not such a big issue. There tends to be more constant rainfall. But throughout the arid West, our dams are intended as much as to capture water and hold for the human need as they are to do the flood prevention. One hydrologist, when we were first modeling a flood after we had done this big model of the earthquake, he said, you got to think of it as though, imagine if you could take that earthquake shaking and bottle it up and sell it next summer. You have a different response to how you do this. And because we have these elaborate flood control systems over much of our territory, flooding becomes in part a decision as well as just what nature's doing to you.
When you do that modeling for, let's say, an earthquake, and I recognize that I'm asking you to really dumb this down for me, but can you talk a little bit about the data that you put in there? How do you sort of pick variables in order to plug into whatever algorithm you're using to model a major earthquake?
Oh, to say what the earthquake's going to be like. Okay. It's a multi-step process. So first we say, what are the faults? We turn to the geologists. And we had to choose a fault. There's several hundred in Southern California. We chose the biggest, longest, fastest moving one because that's the most likely to happen in human time frames. We picked the San Andreas. Then we asked the geologist to tell us how much motion has accumulated on that fault since the last earthquake, right? We have plate tectonics. The plate tectonic engine goes on and on and on and gradually dragging the Pacific Ocean northwest compared to North America. How much has the big plate motion happened since the last earthquake along this section of the fault? And that tells us, we use that to be the average amount of slip, how much one side would slip compared to the other. We also had to choose what section of the fault. So we didn't pick the longest one we could have. We picked one that turned into a magnitude 7.8 because we've seen that twice before. But those were all choices, and the next San Andreas earthquake could be a different part of the fault. It could be some different amount of slip, but those were all very plausible. That was our best guess. Then we had to randomize the slip a bit and make it more like a real earthquake, because if it was all coherent, we would get these huge pulses of energy. The fact that it's in fact a natural system and it runs into things that break up the motion to some extent help keep that from being too bad. Then we turn to the seismologists, and this was probably the most straightforward thing. We have a model of what Southern California's like, how do waves travel through it, which we've gotten from previous earthquakes. And we took that motion on the fault and turned it into seismic waves. And we created a grid that told us what the seismogram would look like at 2-kilometer intervals across all of Southern California. Then we put that into the buildings. And there's a whole algorithm process to say, given this level of shaking, here's the percentage of buildings of certain types that would be damaged. And we came up with an estimate of buildings. And then we turned to teams of experts and brought in a panel about the electric system, a different one about the water system, a different one about dams. We ended up with 17 different panels to say, here's what the seismologists are telling you the shaking is going to be. What do you think is going to happen to your system? So a chunk of the results became expert opinion. And we had to find out what the electrical system was going to do first and then to tell the other industries, here's where you're losing the electricity and when you're getting it back. Now what's going to happen to you? And then we went to public health and said, what are the likely casualties out of this number of downed buildings and this problem with the health system? And then we went to the economists to say, how is the economy going to recover from this? And we went to emergency managers and said, what do you think your response is going to be in this situation? And all of these things got put together. And the main report is 300 pages. The appendices are 800 pages. But we also created a more easily accessible one. We called it the shakeout scenario, the story that Southern Californians are writing. And we start 10 minutes before the earthquake and go to 6 months after describing what it's going to be like in that situation to try and make it more personal.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Yeah, one big takeaway is that a natural disaster is not just the event itself. It is the effects of it are continuing to shape people's lives for months and sometimes years after it happens.
Or decades. I think you can argue that San Francisco lost so much in 1906 that it never recovered back what it had been, or at least not until Silicon Valley came along and really gave it a huge infusion of money. But in 1905, there was no city that mattered on the West Coast besides San Francisco. It was definitely the New York of the West Coast. And the decade after the 1906 earthquake is the largest growth decade in the history of Los Angeles, as people gave up on the Bay Area and came south. So the effects can last for a very, very long time. And, you know, in all these scenario modelings, I said we went to economists and said, estimate the business disruption costs from lack of utilities, looking at how long it would take us to get back the various utilities. And it was interesting, in each of the three cases, a flood, an earthquake, and a tsunami, the business interruption costs were about the same as the direct losses. So for the San Andreas fault, we lose about $100 billion at the moment of the earthquake itself, and another $100 billion from business disruption over the next 6 months.
Should we use public policy to discourage people from rebuilding in places that seem to be vulnerable on an ongoing basis to natural disasters?
I think in some cases, yes. You know, a floodplain of a river is really obvious where exactly where it's going to be. Currently, public policy and the way the flood insurance program is working, we're often encouraging building in those places or right on the coast for a hurricane. On the earthquake side, unless we're willing to walk away from all of California, it isn't just don't build there. We do have policies here in California that you can't build across an active fault. So when the fault moves, you actually rip apart anything that's built across it, and then there's the shaking that goes out elsewhere. And you aren't allowed to build right across the active fault. So some places, yes. As a larger picture, I think we need to just look forward a bit more. And, you know, I think we have found that we can encourage people to support these mitigation measures when they realize that the impact that other people's decisions have on them. Most people believe that the building they own isn't going to come down in the earthquake, but they really don't trust their neighbor's buildings. Sort of like we all believe our own children are above average.
Right.
And so when they recognize that their neighbor's building collapsing will mean they can't use their own building, then they support mitigation for everybody.
So in other words, in a natural disaster, it pays to understand that we're all literally in this together.
Oh, absolutely. And it's also the communities that recover are the ones that care about each other. You know, so the best predictor of a community pulling it back and being able to overcome whatever happened is the degree of social capital, it's called, that people share. If people feel connected to their community, they're willing to stay and put in the hard work to make it get better. So what's going to happen to you individually and how much you individually lose is really going to depend on how much your community is able to hold it together.
Dr. Lucy Jones is a research associate at Caltech. She spent 30 years as a seismologist with the U.S. Geological Survey, most recently as science advisor for risk reduction. Her book, out now in paperback, is called The Big Ones: How Natural Disasters Have Shaped Us and What We Can Do About Them. Lucy, thanks so much for making time for us today.
Oh, thank you. This has been a great discussion.
You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. Use your favorite podcast app to subscribe to the free Think podcast. And check our website if you want to listen to the show or find out what we have planned for upcoming programs. That is think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.